That was Dr. Michael Parenti speaking on corporate monoculture and academic freedom. The talk was given in the late 1980s at the University of Vermont. For more information on Parenti's work or to order tapes of this and other talks, visit his website at www.michaelparenti.org. Parenti, P-A-R-E-N-T-I. This is Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva and WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. Quite a few people most definitely not satisfied, and energetic resistance to the New World Order is emerging worldwide. During the first weeks of May, people in dozens of countries made their feelings known. We will be reading from reports by corporate press wire services, so you can be pretty sure that the numbers of demonstrators have been undercounted.
May 1st, Berlin, AP. Leftists clashed with hundreds of neo-Nazis in Berlin and later fought pitched battles with police. A march against capitalism and imperialism this evening erupted into violence in the Kreuzberg neighborhood, a stronghold of leftist activism. More than 100 police officers were injured as they used water cannons, tear gas, and nightsticks against a crowd of 10,000 anarchists. About 50 people were injured in separate clashes in the port city of Hamburg.
London, AP. Anti-capitalist protesters clashed with the police in central London, tearing down the golden arches of a McDonald's and spray-painting a hammer and sickle on a statue of Winston Churchill in a May Day protest. The protest against global capitalism began peacefully with a guerrilla gardening demonstration in Parliament Square, but degenerated into violence, which resulted in 97 arrests, 26 injuries, and a security bill of £500,000.
Zurich, AP. Swiss police fired tear gas and rubber bullets at revolutionary protesters who smashed windows and damaged cars at a BMW showroom during a march in Zurich. Riot police also used water cannons to disperse the crowd of 1,000 masked youth who staged a separate march to the main parade.
Warsaw, Reuters. Several people were hurt and 14 anarchists were detained during clashes with the police at May Day celebrations in the Polish city of Krakow. Trouble erupted when police tried to block a march by the anarchists on a local jail.
Moscow, Reuters. 15,000 people in Moscow joined a trade union march. Television showed thousands of marchers in St. Petersburg. Reports from throughout Russia spoke of rallies in other cities, mostly by left-wing groups without incident.
The large protests in Istanbul, 15,000, and in the capital of Ankara appeared to be peaceful. The demonstrators were a motley array of unionists, urban leftists, Kurds in colorful traditional garb, and long-haired university students in denim and corduroy. "Damn the IMF! Long live socialist Turkey!" they chanted. Tens of thousands also gathered in Sofia, Madrid, Rabat, Beirut, and Tel Aviv.
Tokyo, AP. Hundreds of thousands of union members attended a May Day rally organized by Rengo, the Japanese Trade Union Confederation, at Tokyo's Yoyogi Park on Monday. A total of 1.7 million people rallied nationwide.
Manila, AP. At least 10 people were injured when Philippine police used truncheons and water cannons to disperse some 12,000 demonstrators in a May Day protest. Thousands of other workers also held peaceful protests in provincial cities across the country. Thousands of students and workers also marched in Seoul and Phnom Penh.
Jakarta, Reuters. Indonesian police opened fire on students in the North Sumatran city of Medan on Monday, killing two and injuring dozens. More than 10,000 workers held a peaceful rally in Medan to mark May Day. In the second largest city, Surabaya, thousands of factory workers marched. In Jakarta, thousands of workers rallied at Parliament calling for the right to form union.
Mexico, AP. Over 45,000 members from 150 organizations and peasants from the National Union of Workers, which split away from the Workers' Congress, took to the streets of the capital on Monday, according to official estimates.
Quito, Ecuador, Reuters. Some 20,000 workers, students, and leftist activists marched through Ecuador's capital, Quito, on Monday. 50 protesters, some of whom were pensioners and children, occupied a colonial church.
Sao Paulo, Brazil, AP. In South America's largest city, Sao Paulo, hundreds of thousands of people gathered to protest low wages and high unemployment.
Portland, Oregon, AP. Firing beanbag rounds from shotguns, police and riot gear tried to break up a downtown May Day protest by hundreds of people. Portland police officers used clubs to shove protesters whose demonstration was organized by a coalition of workers' rights groups. The chaos tied up rush hour traffic. 16 were arrested on charges of disorderly conduct. In Olympia, Washington, several hundred May Day protesters blocked one of the city's busiest intersections to protest global corporations. They set up barricades of old televisions, furniture, vines, and refrigerators. About 400 Minneapolis marchers clashed with police, beating drums and waving flags as officers surrounded them in riot gear, arresting 24. In New York, over 1,000 immigrants and supporters protested outside City Hall with 22 arrests on minor charges. In Chicago, where the U.S. May Day protest movement was born 114 years ago in pursuit of the 8-hour workday, about 900 people ended a day of traffic-disrupting marches through the city center with a rally in Daley Plaza.
May 2nd, Brasilia, Brazil, Reuters. Brazil faced a wave of protests by angry landless peasants on Tuesday as members of the Radical Landless Movement, MST, clashed with police and invaded public buildings and farms in 16 states across Latin America's largest country. The MST invaded government buildings, including the local finance ministries of several states, and attempted to storm the building of the Federal National Development Bank in Rio de Janeiro. Television showed images of violent clashes between the police and crowds of MST supporters in the southern town of Curitiba as the demonstrators were repelled with tear gas. The local finance ministry in Brazil's largest city, Sao Paulo, was also invaded. Impoverished families roamed the countryside, searching for unused plots of land to build makeshift homes and farm basic foodstuffs. According to the Pastoral Land Commission, about half of the nation's arable land is still controlled by a handful of Brazil's wealthiest families.
May 2nd, Oslo, Norway, Reuters. About 85,000 workers went on strike as Norway's biggest labor dispute since the 1980s held up oil exports, closed hotels, and halted ferries. May 8th, Johannesburg, Reuters. A 1.8 million-strong South African Labor Federation threatened on Monday to extend its protest beyond Wednesday's nationwide strike if the government and business did not heed its demands. One of the labor leaders estimated that Wednesday's strike involved up to 3 million workers. He also said the union could no longer tolerate the loss of jobs and benefits in South Africa, where unemployment stands at more than 30%.
Chiang Mai, Thailand, AFP. Anti-capitalism protesters formed a human chain around a luxury hotel hosting the Asian Development Bank's meeting Monday. Several thousand protesters linked arms and chanted slogans, watched by hundreds of riot police lined up around the building as the final day of the conference got underway inside. Protest leaders have threatened they will try to storm the hotel if their demands issued on Sunday for compensation for people affected by the ADB projects and a reassessment of policies are not met. "We will have lunch in the hotel," protesters shouted as they brandished banners sharply critical of the ADB and global finance. Demonstrators claim that ADB policies have exacerbated poverty rather than loosened its grip on Asia, which is home to 70% of the world's poor. It was the latest in a string of demonstrations at the perceived iniquities of global capitalism, which have seen protests at the World Trade Organization talks in Seattle last year, the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, and the meeting of the International Monetary Fund and World Bank in Washington, D.C. The following two speakers were part of a teach-in given last April in Washington, D.C. on corporate globalization. Both will address the role of technology in full corporate control. The first speaker is Jerry Mander. Mander is a director of the International Forum on Globalization and the author of the well-known book, In the Absence of the Sacred. Jerry Mander.
Economic globalization depends upon strong central bureaucracies like the World Bank and the IMF to make and enforce rules that can control, organize, reorganize, redesign the behavior and the structures of nation states so that they become subordinate to corporate free trade. The eventual goal is for all states to adopt identical ideologies, economic ideologies, and identical cultural values, have all of their systems integrated like a standard gauge railway, so there are no obstacles at all to the onset of corporate free trade. As my colleague Andy Kimbrell likes to say, the goal is total control. The kind of total control that they desire is not really going to be possible from the bureaucracies alone. It also requires technological systems of appropriate scale, reach, power, and centralizations appropriate to make global corporations viable as the primary actors they are now and seek to be even more. You also need a convincing way to speak into the minds of billions of ordinary people on the planet, to persuade them that what you've designed for them is the best of all possible worlds, and that corporations are the right institutions to run things. Telecommunications, of course, is very good for that job. It offers the chance via television and other media to speak to the whole world at the same time, like some kind of virtual big brother, and nicely lends itself to central corporate control, as we'll hear a lot more about later. But finally, just in case all that doesn't work out, there's always force. Thomas Friedman of the New York Times, this country's number one cheerleader for globalization, put it extremely well. Quote, "The hidden hand of the market will never work without a hidden fist. McDonald's cannot flourish without McDonnell Douglas. And the hidden fist that keeps the world safe for Silicon Valley technology is called the United States Army." About 2 years ago, right here in Washington at Lisner Auditorium, which I believe is now a locked-out, no-protest zone, we had a teach-in on globalization. Those were the dark old days when it was still hard to get 500 people to show up for anti-globalization events, never mind 50,000 on the streets. But we plugged forward and featured a great debate between our side and theirs. Our side was John Kavanaugh, Maud Barlow, and Vandana Shiva. You'll hear them. And their side featured some of free trade's greatest advocates, notably Joe Cobb of the right-wing Heritage Foundation. Our side won the debate, of course, but Joe Cobb made a very telling point. Responding to the question of whether globalization was inevitable, he answered, "Well, probably globalization could have been stopped a few years ago, but technology has made it inevitable." A few days later, I heard the same remark quoted from Dr. Claude Smadja of the World Economic Forum in Davos. He used the same words. Globalization is inevitable because of technology. Of course, the first question is, how come the right-wingers are so onto that analysis while the rest of us are still kind of celebrating technology? But anyway, I'll leave that hanging for now. Joe Cobb was probably thinking about the telecommunications revolution, but he could also have been thinking about other technologies that have global impact. The automobile, for example. It's surely made the world smaller. It's homogenized landscapes everywhere on Earth. It's caused intense corporate focus on more and more resources, wherever on Earth they are, meaning greater free trade access, and finding more and more markets, meaning greater free trade access, and ever cheaper labor, thus the tremendous interest right now in China. Cars have also brought us oil wars, where the global military gets engaged, as in Iraq and some believe in Kosovo, but we'll come back to that. Cobb could as well have been speaking about robotics or automation, which is replacing workers at an alarming rate in all economic sectors, not only here, but in third world contexts as well. We're used to hearing the complaints that labor is losing jobs to third world workers, but now, even in new high-tech facilities being built by U.S. companies in Asia, workers are losing jobs to no workers. And the situation will quickly get worse as corporate consolidation and giantism bring further economies of industrial scale. Cobb could have been talking about the globalization of high-tech industrialization in mining or forestry or the large dams funded by the IMF and World Bank, as we've heard of so much of today. All of these are examples of the fabulous new technologies that can rip apart forests and landscapes at unprecedented rates and are perfectly suited for large-scale corporate investment and exploitation. All of these have been directly served by the investment rules of the WTO and the loan policies of the World Bank and the IMF. The IMF and the World Bank strongly favor large-scale industrial solutions to poverty, even though all evidence suggests it doesn't relieve poverty, it increases it and destroys nations' abilities to achieve self-reliance, even in the areas of food production, where many nations formerly had it. A great illustration is in agriculture. In most of the world, small farmers had until recently been feeding their families and communities with locally grown, diverse staple food crops. But now the bank, IMF, and WTO, and the big global ag corporations are saying small farmers are not efficient enough. In the United States, 99.5% of homes have television sets. 95% of people watch some television every day. The average home has a TV set going for about 8 hours, even if no one is watching. The average adult viewer actually watches about 4 hours daily. The average child under 12 is watching about 3 hours. These are amazing statistics when you think about them. It means that half the population may be watching more than 4 hours. How's that even possible? They watch on weekends all day. People watch more TV in the U.S. than they do anything else besides sleep or work or go to school. TV's replaced community, it's replaced family, it's replaced the environment. It is the environment. We are the first society to have moved inside media with apparently serious consequences to health, personal alienation, knowledge of basic information, and so on. You have to say, the main thing Americans do is watch television. If you were a Martian anthropologist sent to study Earth people and hovered over the U.S., you'd have to report back something like this. They sit night after night after night in dark rooms. They're staring at a light. Their eyes are not moving. They're not thinking. Their brains are in a passive receptive state. And images are pouring into their brains from thousands of miles away from someplace they are not. The whole thing looks like a massive experiment in mind control, they might say. And that's exactly what it is. This average television viewer in the United States is seeing about 23,000 commercials per year. That's 23,000 repetitions of exactly the same message, delivered in extremely powerful imagery, basically saying the same thing. One may say toothpaste, and one may say cars, But the intent of every one of those 23,000 messages is identical: to get people to view life as a non-stop string of commodity satisfactions. Around the world, most industrialized countries have similar habits. Even the less developed world is saturated with TV, usually delivered by satellite systems. The last time I checked, nearly 80% of the global population that's what we need is make love, not TV. Nearly 80% of the global population had access to TV, most of it with advertising, and very high percentage of it from the United States and Western countries. And heavy viewing is the norm. All over the world, on icy tundras or in grass houses in Borneo or in places where there are not even roads, people are sitting together watching a bunch of white people in Dallas standing around their swimming pools, drinking martinis, and plotting how to steal from each other. A very high percentage of the content throughout the world is still old reruns of American shows, sitcoms, L.A. cop shows, or Baywatch, the most popular show in America in history. Or else it's CNN, that cultural diversity institution. The next question, of course, is who's sending these images? Who's deciding what kind of images goes into the brains of the whole world's population? The vast majority of global television imagery, as well as entertainment imagery and film imagery and books and newspapers too, is sent by a truly tiny number of gigantic global corporations, notably Time Warner, Disney, and Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation. All of them are getting bigger and bigger with each passing day through mergers and consolidations. So, we have the preposterous and terrifying situation of a handful of people in Hollywood and New York implanting the brains of the entire world population with a fantastically concentrated and nonstop dose of powerful images that tell them to hate where they live, love Los Angeles, and believe that buying stuff is the only way to live, and to worship McDonald's, Coca-Cola, and corporations as the answer to their problems. Okay, that's television. That's the old technology. Now we have computers. We have the internet. Now we're free and involved and interactive. We can network with each other and get organized and mold reality to our wishes. But is the internet really our technology? Or, as Joe Cobb seems to think, is it theirs? The ultimate politics of the computer revolution is still unclear, but it's an odd revolution because on all sides, everybody's in agreement. Everybody thinks it's great. The right and the left, the corporations and the activists, the Al Gores and the Bill Clintons and the McCains and the Bushes, the engineers and the artists all express utopian visions of a new democracy and a new empowerment that computers and the internet have brought to us. But is this right? Is it really bringing us closer to democracy or equity? Or is it the opposite? How should we be addressing this point? Wired magazine says that the computer revolution has created an entirely new political structure on the planet. The symbol of today should no longer be the atom, they say. It should be the web or the net. According to this view, the political center has been wiped out by the internet, and an entirely new web structure has emerged that, quote, elevates the power of the small player, unquote, while promoting heterogeneity and a new kind of pure democracy where all are equal players in the global information game. It also brings a new techno-spiritualism, says Wired. Okay, on that last point. Techno-spiritualism. Judging by the amount of time people are ritually engaged with their computers, I would say we've already got that techno-spiritualism. But never mind. As for the political point, that the old political center has been wiped out by our PCs and our emails and web pages, and that we're now in a new computer-enhanced democracy through cyberspace, let me ask this. Should we call that virtual democracy? I think so. Because somebody forgot to tell the transnational corporations in Tokyo, New York, London, and especially Brussels and Geneva that the real power is no longer in the center and that they've lost control. Judging by all the other evidence, centralized corporate power and political power has never accelerated more rapidly than it is now, and the computer has a key role in this. Corporations now use these very same empowered technologies that we do to empower themselves massively, being able to move their stupendous assets around the world at the touch of a key and without any outside observation, causing currencies in the third world countries to be destabilized and cause massive economic infrastructure impacts that serve bankers and speculators and global corporations. So what kind of revolution have we really got here? To use terms like empowerment to summarize the effects of computers is, I think, to misunderstand power in a real political and economic context. Computers do help us as individuals, and they make us feel powerful and competent. And they're surely useful in many ways, as I totally acknowledge. And they can keep us in touch with our colleagues, and they're great for organizing and sending news around about teach-ins and so on. In my opinion, computer technology will eventually be viewed as the most centralizing instrument ever invented. For while we sit at our PCs editing our copy, sending our emails, transnational corporations are using their global networks 24 hours per day with far greater resources, faster and better machines, spread out everywhere on the planet at a scale and speed that makes our level of empowerment pathetic by comparison. In fact, the giant global corporation of today could not exist without the global computer networks to keep their 1,000-armed enterprises in touch and all of their billions of parts moving in the same direction. When they push their buttons on their computers, they're not just sending letters and information to their people. These messages cause hundreds of billions of dollars in resources to be transferred from banks in Geneva to Delhi or Sarawak with concrete results. Forests get cut down, dams get built. So truly, what kind of revolution is this? The electronic revolution has thus far had far more to offer the Joe Cobbs and their friends and the Claude Smadges and their friends than it has to you and me or us. One could even say that the technology, because of its centralizing tendency, has a globalization bias, a corporate bias, a right-wing bias, I think. So, one request. As you continue to use your computers for the very good works you are all engaged in, keep some of this in mind, and let's stop calling them empowering, because somebody else is getting more empowered than we are. And with the recent merger of Time Warner and AOL, and with digitization coming soon, we may be heading for an entire global communication system, internet, television, film, music, the whole deal, satellites, everything controlled by oligopolistic arrangements, three or four companies. Worse, they may all be the same companies. But I'm going to make one more comment on the gigantic push by this government and others to codify one aspect of this revolution, that e-commerce be tax-free globally. In my view, one of the greatest victories we had in Seattle, and the least noticed, was to beat back this idea. The U.S. was pushing hard to codify globally within the WTO that all taxes on e-commerce should be permanently banned. We call that the Bill Gates rule. But thanks to the breakdown of the WTO in Seattle, that rule never passed. But watch out, it's going to come back. If it does pass, it will be one of the greatest corporate boondoggles in history, a subsidy of astounding scale, and an absolute death blow to what are playfully called the old brick-and-mortar businesses. The retail shops and neighborhood stores, the small chains, the bookstores, already disappearing fast, the record shops, businesses that have physical presence where people actually gather. In the third world, the situation will be far worse, as those economies are nearly entirely made of small shops, direct retail, who will be placed in death competitions with global internet companies that exist, if they exist anywhere, thousands of miles away. The situation is already bad for them, but the advantage of no taxes will be the last straw. One could even surmise that it's the purpose of the Bill Gates rule to finally destroy all the old traditional economies in favor of a new globalized e-commerce system that functions on an entirely different plane with far more powerful actors. It's nothing less than an attempt to eliminate the old economic system of small producers, small retailers, small businesses, who till now have had some chance to survive, and replacing it with global internet e-commerce trade brought by corporations from thousands of miles away. The devastation to local economies that would go with this is beyond the imagination, as well as the devastation to cultures, livelihoods, and political structures of small and poor countries. So much for the internet empowering the small players. Okay, so we have the industrial forestry and agriculture revving up the takeover of small producers. We have robotics and automation eliminating industrial service jobs. We have biotechnology and life patenting making it impossible for small farmers to survive. We have the whole world with its head in the television set, gathering images from three super mega corporations, cloning and homogenizing consciousness. And now we have a technology sold to us as democratic, but in practice centralizing for corporations and the ability of small countries and threatening the ability of small countries and small producers to survive. Are people going to stand for that? Maybe not. In fact, they're already protesting. We have millions of people protesting in India, hundreds of thousands in Europe, and we have tens of thousands now in the U.S., and we've barely just begun. Can we turn it around? Of course we can. But what does the military have to say about it? Which brings me to the last piece of this puzzle. One of the least known yet most important facts about the WTO is that the only sector of the international economy those lines are better than the regular ones. The only sector of the international economy that has been formally excluded from the rules of the WTO and other bureaucracies is the military. The WTO butts in on every country's social and environmental policies, but when it comes to the military, it contains a so-called security exemption. It's found in Article 21 of the GATT Agreement, which has now been folded into the WTO. The security exemption allows any and all subsidized and protections for armament, development, and trade. Subsidies and protections for armament, development, and trade. If a country says, it allows these subsidies and protections if a country says it is in its essential national interest. That's the operative phrase. This specifically includes trade in armaments, ammunition, and implements of war, which is a big hunk of the global economy. What makes Article 21 so powerful is that governments define for themselves their essential security interests, thus making it possible for them to fold all kinds of economic activity within this exemption, and thus protecting against controls or even oversight. To give you an idea of how the military sees our essential national interests, I have here a publication from United States Space Command. It's called Vision for 2020, and it says this. Historically, military forces have evolved to protect national interests and investments, both military and economic. During the rise of sea commerce, nations built navies to protect and enhance their commercial interests. During the westward expansion of the United States, the cavalry emerged to protect our railroads, wagon trains, and settlements. The emergence of space power follows both of these models. U.S. Space Forces will protect military and commercial national interests and investment from space. And it goes on to speak about space dominance. So Thomas Friedman had it right. Here's my conclusion. One, the golden triangle of bureaucracies have the job to make the rules of conformity to adhere to globally centralized corporate control. Two, the technologies appropriate to global scale corporate operations are now in place, which together with the rules make voracious, vicious development possible. Three, global communication systems are homogenizing consciousness and values and offering central control of consciousness by corporations. And four, the security dimension, revving itself up to protect a global system that, as we learned in Seattle, may not be as invincible as it looks. Thanks for your attention. Apologies for going on too long.
That was Jerry Mander speaking on technology and who it mostly serves. Next, we'll hear from Andy Kimbrell. Kimbrell is a public interest attorney and the founder of the Center for Technology Assessment in Washington, D.C. He has won numerous lawsuits against the biotechnology industry and the patenting of life. He is the author of several books, including The Human Body Shop and The Masculine Mystique.
Hello, everybody. You know, the rhetoric of the Clinton administration and virtually all the globalization proponents is, you've heard it all, right? Freedom, open borders, liberation, fostering democracy. This is a complete lie. That the reality is far, far different. Behind that rhetoric actually lies an extraordinary corporate and government technological and technocratical infrastructure of virtual total control. Control of our communities, societies, individuals, traditions, even the genes of our bodies. You've seen where a handful of corporations are running the entire media, resulting in that virtually the majority of the world's population at this point succumbing to that numbing of the monoculture of the mind that Vandana Shiva talks about. We've seen our entire military retooling so it can fight 3 to 5 police actions around the globe. We all know what that means. One of them may occur this weekend. Jerry talked about the extraordinary power that computers allow this globalization system. I don't know how many people heard about the Echelon. People know about the Echelon program, multi-governmental program using computer technology to analyze every message, right? Every electronic message transferred on Earth at all times. Not science fiction, actual fact happening today. So while we all enjoy the power we have over computers, we cannot forget, as Jerry reminded us, that this power gives exponentially more power to the corporations than it does to us. We all, of course, know about these new technocratic structures that have usurped democracy around the world, including this country, those Bretton Woods monsters that we're here to confront, challenge, and stop. A couple things we didn't mention that I think are kind of interesting. I don't know how many people are familiar with the new satellite technology, another gift to the military-industrial establishment that Steve and Randy did such a great job talking about. We now have virtual complete mapping of the world through satellites at all times, 24 hours a day, 1 meter resolution, right? 3 feet. One of these now several corporations are doing it. I talked to one guy. I said, you know, we used to be able to tell whether you had a pool. We can now tell what you're wearing in your pool. Maybe some of the most chilling control and something I deal with on a daily basis is the new ability of these technologies to mix, match, and change the very genetic makeup of the entire living kingdom. To search the world for valuable genetic material, to steal it, to patent it, and to change the very physiology of the microbes, plants, animals, and yes, humans, the world to fit their profit research needs. Total control, from the skies to the gene. That's what they're about. That's what they do. It's got nothing to do with freedom. It's got nothing to do with democracy. It's got nothing to do with liberation. They're managers. They're managers in their souls. They're managers in their mind. And that's what they want to do, is manage and control. That's all they want to do. So let's call it what it is. Now, what do the World Bank and IMF have to do with all this? They're the pushers of this technological invasion, right? They're the financial viruses that infect the rest of the world so this control can happen. You know, if you look at what they actually finance, it becomes very, very clear what they're about. Over the last 20 years, about 50% of IMF and World Bank investment has involved either energy systems, transportation systems, or new industrial agricultural systems. Right. Ideas to go into countries around the world, destroy their native and indigenous agricultural systems, completely alter their social relationships, completely reallocate their resources so they will fit monolithic industrial energy, transportation, and food production systems. The World Bank lists as its number one job technology transfer. Get on the IMF website, go ahead and do it. We know they're just basically the surveillance arm of the World Bank, right? But you know what they say their number one job is too? Technology transfer. That's what we're all about. That's what we're here to do. And by the way, you know the number one good that's sold in this new global market? Largest single component study. IPS just came out with a study. The automobile. Automobile parts. Any infrastructure that allows for the automobile. Number one. Of course, it's also number one cause of global warming. Robert Graves, the poet, wonderful poet, said he'd become a Catholic when the Pope issued an encyclical against the combustion engine. Unfortunately, he'd still be waiting. But all this brings up, I think, something which for me is very, very important. You know, I come from an old left-wing New York family, and most of my relatives spent most of their lives in the union movement, organizing. And I was brought up pretty early to know that the great struggle of the world was ownership of the means of production, right? You've got all this technology that the last few centuries have given us, and the big battle is who's going to own it? Who's going to get the profits? Over the last 20 years, I've learned a different lesson, actually. Not that that is not a terribly important battle, and not that many brave women and men fought and died fighting that battle. But I think we miss something on the way. We miss something that this globalization process points out. This total control points out. While we were worried about the politics of the ownership of the means of production, we forgot about the politics of the means of production themselves. We forgot that technology has a politics. That technology is legislation. That technology is a political act. One of the most pernicious habits of thought, pieces of propaganda we hear all the time is technology is neutral. Well, I'm here to tell you technology is never neutral. Technology always represents power. Power over something. From the hammer to the nuclear bomb, it represents power. And the question is that power appropriate? And what changes is that power make occur wherever that technology goes? Let me give you an example. Okay? Let's talk about the conservatives' favorite, nuclear power. What do you need for a nuclear power plant? Here the World Bank, and it's done this often, is going to loan, it's an investment bank, that's all it really does, right? It's going to loan millions, billions of dollars for nuclear power plants. It's done this all over the world. Several in Brazil alone. What do you get along with a nuclear power plant? Is it a neutral technology? What do you need to build it? A lot of water. That's right. What else you need? Lots of uranium. Military elite, you bet. What else? A lot of money. Brings us right back to our friends at the World Bank, doesn't it? It has to be a huge capital investment. You got to get it from somewhere. What else? Right, scientific elite, you need your engineers. Yeah, you got some kind of, you got to waste, get rid of the waste somehow. Barry Common always used to say building a nuclear power plant was like building a home without a bathroom. And people are going to argue forever about where that stuff's going to go. And the U.S. Congress is still arguing, by the way. What else do you need? Right. This is what our conservative friends say, our right-wing friends, I should say, are always saying, well, listen, we've got, we love this technology, but we hate bureaucracy. You've got some major cognitive dissonance there, babe. Well, that helps too. Well, that goes with the money. What you got here is huge bureaucracies, right? You need a bureaucracy for safety. You need a bureaucracy to disseminate this huge amount of information, of energy to millions of people, right? It's a totally inappropriate technology, very dangerous. Someone said it's like cutting butter with a chainsaw, because all it really does is boil water. So when you get a nuclear power plant, what kind of society are you going to get? Let's count it up. One that requires huge capital investments, exhausts its resources. You have a military elite. You have a scientific elite. You have massive bureaucracies, right, for safety, for energy dissemination. You've got a technocratized, technologized, elitist society. And what about the citizen? All right? What about you and me? Now, we're sitting here. Okay, let's all get together on one huge conference call. It's called Washington Power. And we say, you know what? We've taken a vote. We all oppose nuclear power. We want to make absolutely certain that the energies that's coming into this building during this very important meeting is not coming from Calvert Cliffs nuclear power plant. So stop it right now. What would the response be? Probably massive laughter. I just got this call. You can't believe. Right? Because not only does this impose a technological and totalitarian infrastructure in a society dominated by military elites, scientific elites, and bureaucracies, it completely disempowers the citizen. You have no power. Ethics 01, can you take responsibility for this technology? No. Can it be responsive to you? No. And when you build your entire society out of these technologies, it's ludicrous to call yourself a democracy because you have a complete totalitarian infrastructure. You say, well, I'm not so sure of that. Well, go to work. Because what does this do to work? The vast majority of Americans don't work in a democracy. They work in a totalitarian state. Whether it's a corporation, whether it's a bureaucracy, they work in a totalitarian state. Not that we're not fighting for workplace democracy, as we should. Let's get real about that. The second thing it does, and Jerry mentioned this, and I was thinking about this as he was talking, it cocoons us, right? This technological milieu that we've created in this infrastructure, it turns us into cocoons. Look at that automobile. We're totally cocooned in an artificial environment. You know, I walk my dog at night, and I look in, and no one's talking on the streets. No one's communicating like that even when I was a kid. Everybody else sees little blue lights flashing through the windows? Everyone's in front of some screen or another. Kids aren't talking to their parents. Why talk to them anyway? Because generations don't understand this technology. It's cocooned us, and that cocooning is very, very dangerous. Right? It turns us into the perfect soft managerial state because we are so cocooned into these technologies that are given to us, these conveniences of which we have no control, that we don't even talk to each other. The greatest threat to the First Amendment in the United States, I'm telling you this right now, is the television and the computer. You can forget everything else. They are stopping more speech, more communication than anything else you could possibly imagine. And in these cocoons, I think the tragedy I see as I get older is how they've made us autistic. They've made a society autistic to the natural world and to the terrible tragedies that things like globalization cause socially. And Washington is a great town to see it for those of you who are visiting. Watch these people walking down the street. They are totally autistic to the suffering they're causing to the natural world, to the crimes that they are creating around the world. Pardon? I can't hear you. They are cut off by their cocooning. They're completely cut off from any appreciation of the natural world and from an empathy with the people they're with. And there is a reason for that. There's a reason that they are cut off. It was mentioned a little bit before, but I think, you know, we are not only fighting a new force in society that's destroying our democracy through technology, and this is this technocratic infrastructure, we're fighting an ideology. They do have an ideology. And it's the ideology they're imposing to their structural adjustment programs, ideology they're opposing through their loans. Yes, an ideology that they will end up and are enforcing through the new military. It's the cult of efficiency. Get on those websites. I did last week. The World Bank, IMF. There's about 50 mentions of efficiency. All we're trying to do is to make local economies more efficient. That's all we're trying to do. You know, when I was doing research on my book on genetic engineering, I went to the USDA. They let me in because this is before I sued them. And I was investigating a really horrible experiment. They were taking human genes. Dr. Vern Purcell, actually, right up here in Beltsville, Maryland, was taking human genes, putting in the permanent genetic code of cows. He wanted to create a super cow. Some guy named Ralph Brinster had done this at the University of Pennsylvania in 1982. He'd taken human genes and he put them into a mouse and created a super mouse, a really huge mouse. and they had the front cover of Science magazine and Nature magazine. You saw this huge mouse and its sibling, little mouse. The huge mouse had the human gene in every cell of its body. Little mouse didn't have the cell. It was a wonder. A few months passed, and people asked an important question: what good is a really huge mouse? Outside of Halloween or a couple of, perhaps. So Purcell got the idea: I'm going to create a really huge pig. The same way. I went up and saw it, pig 6707. I describe it in the book, and he couldn't stand up. He was bow-legged. He was arthritic. The picture I took of it, I sent it to a slide. You had to put him up against a plywood board because he couldn't stand up. It was a very tragic creature. And I asked Dr. Purcell, what are you trying to do here? He said, I'm trying to make the pig more efficient. This writ large is what the World Bank does. Now, this cult of efficiency, if I were to tell you, which is true, that I have two teenage children, a daughter and a son, and I treat them very efficiently, we all know what efficiency is, right? Maximum output for minimum input in minimum time. Right? Okay, that's how I treat my kids. Right? Maximum input of minimum input of food and affection for a maximum output of good grades. I promise by my daughter that she will not slam doors. Right? What about my pet? My beloved dogs. Treat them efficiently? They don't do any work. I mean, they like pee on rugs and eat baseball gloves. What about your friends? Treat your friends efficiently? 2 a.m. call. Andy, I can't believe it. Bob left me. Sorry, inefficient phone call. I have a speech to give tomorrow. Check off. Inefficient friend. Do we treat anything we truly care about on an efficiency basis? Absolutely not. And yet here we have the World Bank, the IMF, saying we should treat every society, every individual, the entire natural world solely based on efficiency. That is pathological. Efficiency is the right logic for machines, right? This is this politics of technology. It's not the right logic for human thing or any living thing. There's one other piece of this ideology which is important for us to remember, and that's marketism. Right? We don't often talk about this. You can go through whole conferences and the C word, capitalism, is not often mentioned. But let's face it, right? That's their ideology, marketism, free markets. It's a religion. We've talked, some of the prophets have been spoken about before, Milton Friedman, Maynard Keynes. Marketism. And marketism is based on the concept of competition. Now, we know it doesn't really happen. But what about competition? Let's run that through a little test. What if I had my kids compete and said, whoever gets better grades stays in the house? Other one, you're gone. Sorry? It's the only efficient thing we can do. It's how the market works, baby. Pathological, right? You certainly wouldn't go out with, you know, for a beer with me based on that, would you? All right, this guy is sick. That's exactly the logic of the World Bank, IMF, WTO, and our entire world market system. Winners and losers. We're going to be the winners, says President Clinton. They're going to be the losers. Losers means starvation, right? Environmental destruction, every catastrophe you can imagine. Competition is the ethic of isolation. It is the destruction of cooperation, the destruction of empathy. Again, a pathological ethic by which to have the basis of an entire world system. Efficiency, competition, that's their ideology. We have to balance efficiency with empathy, dare we say the word love, and we have to balance competition with cooperation. Every evolutionary biologist will tell you the species only survive, not through competition, pace social Darwinist, but through cooperation. That was nice. I like that. Let me mention one more thing, because you're going to get hit with it just like I get hit with it all the time. I'll finish up with this. They'll say, that's all great, Andy, but we've got to make progress. Love you, guy, but we've got to make progress. President Clinton said at the end of his last State of the Union speech, we all are united in one belief in this country, and I knew he was going to say God. I was wrong. He said, we all still believe in progress. Now, progress is an incomplete sentence. Don't you dare, any of us dare, let anybody ever use that word without having them finish that sentence. Progress towards what? Genetic engineering, satellites, this new defense, everything you've heard about today, which is the new technologies, is not progress. It is not the world, the future vision any of us want to see. Any of us want to see. You know what? Millions of people know that. You know, the great thing about saying freeze, which Randy was so great, and so many others in fighting and starting, was they had the courage to say no to a technology. Over the last 30 or 40 years, many people have said, we're saying no to industrial food. We're saying no to GE Foods. And by the way, FDA right now is asking for your opinion. Absolutely no to GE Foods. Millions of people are saying no to television. We're not going to be part of the grid. We have to have the courage to say no. That's the thing we've learned from these movements. You know, restrict your consumption. I think people are so frustrated by meaningless work, and that's the only thing they can think of doing. 36 years ago, a teach-in very similar to this in Berkeley, Mario Savio, who died a couple years ago, said something which I think is so apt for this whole new technological politics, which I hope I've convinced you is what we're really fighting here, and against the technological pushers, IMF and World Bank. He said this: there is a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. You've got to put your bodies on the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, and the whole apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, and everyone is free, the machine will be prevented from working at all. Amen, Mario.
That was public interest attorney Andy Kimbrell.
The music used in today's program was Unsatisfied by the Replacements and Lost in the Supermarket by The Clash. If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us through our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. You can also download shows you may have missed or get more info on the topics covered. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
You still catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle.